Universal Credit has been dubbed one of the most radical changes to the British welfare system since the Beveridge Report, which proposed widespread reforms to the social welfare system to tackle what Beveridge identified as five giant evils in society: squalor, ignorance, want, idleness, and disease. Since Beveridge, the welfare system has continued to morph. Since World War II, we've added child benefits, housing benefit, tax credits, I could go on. The list kept growing. The National Audit Office calculated that there were 24 different kinds of benefit. Now, many have argued that this has created a new series of problems, mainly that people have been deterred from taking jobs, fearing that they would in fact end up worse off than they were on benefits. A system designed to help people out of poverty has arguably become a poverty trap. But given that the Trussell Trust is concerned about links between universal credit, financial hardship, and food bank use, is it time to scrap universal credit? Or does the programme have the right ideas, suffering from poor implementation? Joining me to discuss is the IEA's economics fellow Julian Jessop and Patrick Spencer from the Centre for Social Justice, the think tank which I think can claim to be the brains behind the thinking behind universal credit. So hello to both of you. Patrick, I want to start with you. On that point, the idea behind universal credit was intended to make work pay. Is there evidence that it is actually working? And I want you to give a brief overview of what universal credit actually is.
Okay. Great opening question. So to go back to the origins of universal credit, you've got to go back to 2003 that Ian Duncan Smith was suddenly stood down as leader of the Conservative Party, and he took a step back from frontline politics, and he really wanted to rethink, well, hang on a minute, I want to continue serving my country, but I've got to find something to focus on. And he had long had a problem with the fact that the Conservative Party struggled with the notion of social justice. And he wanted to try and weave that back into the Conservative narrative. So he went on a massive listening tour around the country and came across one thing that really stuck with him. He met many, many people who wanted to work but couldn't work because of the very complicated, antiquated welfare system that they faced. And you're right in your description of the welfare system that you have a huge plethora of different entitlements that someone can claim. I think actually before the introduction of universal credit, there was 21 different working age welfare entitlements. A system where if they got a job, they would move from jobs seekers allowance to income support. And income support was reduced by £1 for every £1 that they earned. So it had 100% marginal tax rate. And that continued up until about 16 hours of work a week, when all of a sudden working tax credits would come in and you'd see marginal tax rates go up and incomes shoot through the roof. Mm-hmm. And that would carry on until about the 26, 27 hour mark. And all of a sudden working tax credits were reduced at phenomenally high rates. So, you know, Ian was absolutely perplexed with this complicated system that disincentivized someone from getting a job. And he understood a job as essential for helping people establish some independence in their life. It was essential for economic and social mobility. It was essential. It was the best route out of poverty. So in 2009, the CSJ published a paper called Dynamic Benefits, and it laid the foundation for a dynamic benefit system that combined six of the major working age welfare entitlements. That's child tax credit, housing benefit, income support, income-based JSA, income-related ESA, and working tax credits. And universal credit was designed that so whether you're in work or out of work, you'd be claiming UC, and the marginal tax rates would be lowered and kept at a fairly constant rate. I think the original rate was about 45-55%. Actually, today it's 63%. But what it ensured was that there was no disincentive to anyone who was currently out of work to get into work. And as to the evidence of whether this is working today, I think, and it'll be interesting to get Julian's thoughts on this, I think UC is too often conflated with some of the other things that people get upset about. So you often read about stagnating wages and gig economy employment not paying, and you know, scrupulous employers not paying their staff properly. That's not the same as universal credit. Universal credit has been rolled out fully across the country, and marginal tax rates are below where they were for the old system. There are small problems around certain parts of universal credit, for instance, debt repayment. So if you've got debt on universal credit, those get reduced at quite a high rate, but it's quite a small chunk of the total claimant population. And so that all the evidence suggests, whether it's claimant surveys or the data, suggests that yes, universal credit has achieved its original purpose of making work pay.
Do you agree with that, Julian?
I do. I think it has been a factor contributing to the fact that we now have a very low level of unemployment and record rates of employment. So I think it's certainly contributed to the overall welfare of the economy. But I wouldn't downplay the impact it's had on some individuals. Stepping back a bit, the reform of universal credit is an absolutely massive change. If it weren't for the fact we're spending most of our time talking about Brexit, I think this would be at or near the front of the news every single day. Potentially up to 7 million households who are going to be affected by this, including many of the most vulnerable in society. And for those obsessed about the money aspect, it's about £60 billion a year in public spending. So I think it's extremely important to get it right for all sorts of reasons. I think the principles behind universal credit are absolutely the correct ones. I mean, the old legacy system was frankly bonkers. I mean, all these different benefits with different eligibility criteria withdrawn at different rates, actually administered by two different departments as well, the Department for Work and Pensions and by HMRC. But the way that the new system has been rolled out has undoubtedly caused problems. I mean, the one thing in particular I think I would focus on is the delay of up to 5 and sometimes even 6 weeks before benefits are paid. And this, of course, is for people who by definition are surviving from week to week, who don't have large amounts of savings to tide them over. So I think if there were the one reform I would make, it's to shorten that period. That is already going to happen from next year. The period will be shortened. But for many people, waiting a year is too long. I think we need to act now to shorten that waiting period and to put a bit more money into some of the transitional payments as well.
It had an ambition, an aspiration embedded in it. That said, that in fact, we don't just want to park people on benefits. We want the welfare system to be an enabler for people who perhaps were completely forgotten under the previous government. And the reason that people are paid in arrears is part of that. People are paid in arrears largely because they want to replicate the world of work, and people are... The other point you make about people being paid in arrears and being paid directly as opposed to, so for instance, housing benefit under universal credit is paid directly to you as opposed to straight to a landlord. Mm-hmm. The reason that is because universal credit believes people should have a right to decide what to do with their own money. We shouldn't treat welfare claimants like children. We shouldn't treat welfare claimants like they aren't responsible enough to manage their own financial affairs. Yes, it has created some problems, and in some parts of the policy sphere it has been unpopular, but we can debate how best to implement universal credit over a prolonged period of time, but the reason those were introduced is because it had something that the previous welfare system didn't have, which is aspiration.
Julian, I mean, you've mentioned there that the reason, I think a lot of people, the criticisms tends to be that actually being in a job in 2019 is not enough actually to escape in-work poverty. That's the real problem that we aren't addressing here. I mean, do you think there's much truth to that charge?
Well, I think this runs into the problem of what do you mean by poverty? I think if you ask most people, what they mean by poverty, they basically mean destitution. It's not having enough money to make do from week to week, and that's where reliance on things like food banks is relevant. But often when campaigners and politicians talk about poverty, what they're actually talking about is a relative measure of poverty, which is really about income inequality. So that, for example, might be earning less than, say, 60% of the median wage. Now, the problem with that measure, first of all, of course, many more people will fall into that category than those who are genuinely destitute. But also, because it's a measure of income inequality, it's quite possible for that measure to go up or down, depending on the income distribution, rather than whether the people at the bottom of the distribution are actually genuinely suffering. I think there's a danger. If you focus too much on measures of income inequality, you miss the bigger picture. The priority is surely to help those people at the bottom, regardless of where they are relative to those towards the middle or the top. When people talk about people still being in poverty while having a job, I think, as I say, they're focusing too much on that relative measure of income inequality, not on what I would understand as poverty. As it happens, well, there's no guarantee that having a job will lift you out of relative poverty. It's still the case that having a job means you're far more likely to be outside that category of poverty than in. Plus, there are, of course, all sorts of non-economic benefits of being in work. I mean, there's, you know, the satisfaction of no longer being dependent on the state. There's the satisfaction of going to work, the social networks that provides and so on. So even if there were actually no change in people's incomes, I'd still much rather that they were at work than out of work and dependent on the state.
Is that your view, Patrick?
Singing from the same hymn sheet. One of the things that most frustrates me is looking at the impact on the relative poverty measure if you see an increase or decrease in the median wage. If you see a decrease in the median wage, relative poverty goes down. I don't understand how that's ever going to lead us to better policy making. And also, if you see an increase in the median wage, a fundamentally good thing, you see a relative increase in relative poverty. To the point about the impact of work on poverty and low-income poverty, DWP statistics came out the other day that shows that the proportion of people in work under the arbitrary poverty line is about 10%. The proportion of people who are out of work who fall under the arbitrary poverty line is about 40%. That means if you do not have a job, you have increased the probability of falling under the poverty line by a factor of four. The growth in in-work poverty is really a statistical phenomenon caused by the high employment rates. The relationship between work and economic empowerment and independence from the state and social mobility and economic mobility is as true as it ever has been.
I mean, I hate when people use personal anecdote as evidence, but I can remember, you know, my mother always said and continues to say that the proudest moment of her life was when she bought her council house and a right to buy, because then she had an asset and she felt her behaviour completely changed, and we recognise that as children. But do you know, this is different than buying a council house. This is replacing six benefits into one. Is that not just far too ambitious?
Interesting question. Let me try and answer it in two parts. First of all, it was ambitious, but it's technologically feasible. Mm-hmm. I think in the old days when people applied for welfare and benefits literally using paper and it was put into a, you know, process, I think that would have been incredibly complicated. Now we have the benefits of big data and technology that allows for us to really compute someone's entitlement very quickly. Yeah. In terms of trying to, as you said in your opening statement, introduce the largest welfare reform since Beveridge, yes, it was hugely ambitious, but it was the right thing to do. I'm not speaking on behalf of the government. I can speak on behalf of the policy sector, I suppose. But the government probably should have been more aware of the very complex situations that people who were claiming universal or expected to claim universal credit found themselves in, and they should have probably prepared to support those people more, yes. But in terms of ambition, you know, I think it's the right thing to do.
Julian?
I would agree with that. I mean, I can see some appeal in having more benefits rather than fewer. I mean, in principle, if you have a wider range of benefits, it does bring greater flexibility, especially when family circumstances change. I mean, another advantage of having a wider range of benefits is that you can target them better. When you're moving to the universal credit system, there are undoubtedly some types of claimant who are going to be winners, but also some who are going to be losers. So, for example, many single parents and two-earner couples with children might in principle be worse off. But I think you can recognise that in the system. You know, there are the things that you can do to compensate the losers while still making sure that the the winners are better off. I think that's a question of the design of the detail of the system rather than the overall idea. I mean, we know that, you know, any system, the more complicated it is, the more distortions it introduces. So I think the overarching aim of reducing the number of benefits in favour of a simpler system is absolutely the right way to go.
A lot of people on the left and the right, you've got McDonnell, who had, I think he set up a commission to look into universal basic income, but you've also got champions of it on the right as well, who argues that that is the ultimate way to simplify our sort of labyrinth tax system, welfare system rather. What are your thoughts on that, Patrick?
Okay, so I think you can separate the people who support UBI into two groups.
Right.
You've got the purists who honestly believe that we should give a lump sum to every household in the UK regardless of their income. I personally don't feel brilliant in advocating a system that supports welfare for rich households, but I respect their position. The problem I have is on the other side of the spectrum, which says we should introduce UBI, but there will be some caveats. We want to claw back your universal basic income entitlement to rich households. And you say, right, well, okay, then we've got to introduce some kind of tax rate, which increases the complexity of it. Then they say, well, hang on a minute, there will also be added UBI support for people with two children, three children, four children. Okay, fine. What about those people who need support in housing? Ah, yes, well, we're going to introduce a housing element to UBI as well. And all of a sudden, those people who advocate for a simpler UBI system will suddenly show you a system that has high marginal tax rates. The higher up the more hours you work, complexity around reductions towards housing elements, child elements, and all these other things, and it suddenly you arrive at an even more complicated and counterintuitive system that you even had before universal credit was introduced.
Can't you argue that with universal credit though, Julian? It seems to me that there's a top up here and a top up there. Can't you argue that that's becoming a more complex system?
The difference, of course, is that universal credit isn't available to everybody, regardless of income, which will be the situation under universal basic income. I mean, I'm a pragmatist here. I thought if people could make a case that universal basic income would work, then I'd be happy to support it. But in practice, if you are intending it to replace other benefits, it has to be set at such a high level that, first of all, it would cost an awful lot of money that has to come from somewhere else, so, you know, obviously from higher taxes, but also it would provide a disincentive to work. So the opposite of what universal credit is doing. If it were set at a high enough level, then, you know, why bother to work if the state basically is going to support you? So I think the basic problem with universal basic income is if it's going to achieve what it is said to be aiming to achieve, then it has to be set at such a high level that in practice it wouldn't work.
And at the same time, you'd argue that, well, if you introduce a universal basic income, we shouldn't have the need for an NHS and a state education system, because, you know, your UBI should be able to support your interaction with the private market in all those respects. And those, when you face those arguments, people suddenly shut down.
Okay, I want you to both put your sort of imagination caps on for a second and imagine that you're called into the Department of Work and Pensions. And is Amber Rudd still Secretary of State? She is still Secretary of State, isn't she? It changes like God knows what now. Musical chairs. I want you to imagine that she calls you in and she says, okay, Julian and Patrick, what changes would you make to universal credit in order to make it work? I'll start with you, Julian.
Well, first of all, I'll focus on what I suggested earlier, which is to reduce the minimum payment period for 5 weeks, to perhaps as little as two, if that is practically possible. But I would also do a few things to make the system a little bit more generous. So I'll have less reliance on advances on future benefits to tie people over the transition. If that does mean that in the short run people get a bit more money than might otherwise have done during the transition, then so be it. And I'd also look at the interaction between universal credit and other welfare changes that are going on. I think part of the problem, as Patrick was suggesting earlier, was that a lot of the things that are attributed to universal credit are actually other things that are going on at the same time. So, for example, the freeze on benefits. I think you have to recognise if you're doing a major reform like universal credit, that's probably not the time to be introducing other things that might make life harder than they would otherwise have been for some of the most vulnerable in our society.
If you look at where perhaps universal credit has struggled. It's struggled in supporting people with really complex issues, those people who might face mental or physical disabilities, those people who have been out of the labour market for a long time, those people who have got caring responsibilities, childcare, dependents. And I think we could have done more to support job centre staff and support those claimants. I think actually if you wanted to invest in universal credit now, might not be in the actual structured payment of it, it would be in the support staff who can actually help people on the ground. Universal support was a policy that was designed alongside universal credit, which allowed for job centre staff to point and direct people who they would consider vulnerable or complex claimants towards tailored support. So if they were having troubles with their housing, they could direct them to a housing charity. If they had problems with their skill attainment level, they could direct them to someone who could help them increase their skill level. I think if I was going to advise Amber Rudd on doing anything right now, I would say invest in job centre staff, invest in universal support, and help the most vulnerable people in the country get onto universal credit.
Finally, another question actually from the Secretary of State. What lessons do you think the implementation of universal credit does the state need to learn from actually for future welfare reform? I'll start with you, Patrick.
Tricky question. If I'm honest, I think it's a little bit too early to draw any major lessons from this. I would perhaps say two things, though. First of all, to Julian's point, the cuts introduced in 2015 were not the right cuts to make. There was a lot of money taken out in 2015, which preceded Ian Duncan Smith's resignation from government. It's absolutely right to say if you're going to introduce the biggest welfare reform in over 50 years, you probably shouldn't coincide it with structural changes to the level of entitlement. So I think that's one thing I would say. Second of all, perhaps some more pilots would have been a good idea, trying to predict, forecast, and understand how you get the most vulnerable people onto universal credit. I was at a talk with DWP recently where they were coming around to the realisation that sending letters was probably not a good idea for people who were very socially detached and isolated and didn't want to open their post with high levels of debt. That if you go onto the DW website, it is word heavy, perhaps not ideal for someone who isn't very good at reading or doesn't interact well with technology. I think there was probably things they could have done differently in the rollout phase that made it much more consumer friendly.
Julian?
Well, I'd agree, first of all, with the thing that Patrick has just said. I would add the importance of talking to experts. And House of Commons Public Accounts Committee was flagging up major problems with universal credit, I think as early as 2013. So these problems have been brewing for a while. And by experts, I don't just mean economists and you know, specialists in the tax and benefit system, but I mean people on the front line of providing services to those most at need. I mean, you quite rightly flagged up the role of the Trussell Trust here, the country's biggest provider of food banks. And I think they have provided many important insights to the impact that universal credit was having, in particular, you know, hard evidence of the harm that was being caused to at least some people by the delay before benefits were paid. So I think it's important to you know, keep an open mind and to listen to people who are out there on the front line dealing with the practical problems that such a major benefit reform is bound, I think, to introduce. Equally, though, it's absolutely the right thing to do. I mean, universal credit is absolutely the right reform to make. It would be a real shame if the principles of universal credit were lost because of some poor implementation at the edges.
All right.
I mean, just the point about it being the right thing to do. I made a note because I wanted to bring this up today. You know, France are now looking to put in place, famous for their indulgent welfare system. And now, you know, the reforms that Macron's introducing around the labour market, they want to introduce a welfare system that is similar to universal credit. The Finns, after trialling a UBI system, are now looking to introduce a universal credit style system. Universal credit, that dynamic benefit structure, is very similar to the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit that was introduced in America, that's been hugely successful at supporting vulnerable women into the labour market. If we were to throw universal credit out now, I think it would be disastrous.
Thank you very much for joining me, Patrick and Julian.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Universal Credit. I'll post a link in the text of this podcast. You can get more podcasts, films and reports on the IEA website at iea.org.uk.